As you can see from looking at me, there's a pretty good generation gap here. And so I'm a little concerned tonight as to how this is all going to compute, how it's all going to connect. I guess we have one thing in common, however, and that is that each one of us is on a spiritual journey. And we have that in common. Unfortunately, I'm probably closer to the end of my journey than you are, but that's the way it goes. That's part of life. And so maybe there's some things that we can talk about tonight that would be of some relevance. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My journey started a long time ago, 1937, probably before most of you were born. Hastings, Nebraska. Town out in the middle of the state, 22,000. And 1937, many of you probably are vaguely aware of that time, but it was a difficult time. It was still during the Depression, the Great Depression. Today, unemployment is around 8%. At that time, it was closer to 30% nationally. There were bread lines, the Dust Bowl. Dust clouds, would come along and there'd be that much dust and dirt on the floor inside a house. Somehow it'd get in there. Crops were pretty well gone. Pretty tough time. And my dad traveled. He had a job, fortunately, so he traveled Monday through Friday. Come home Friday night, he'd go to work on Saturday. And I'd see him on Sunday and a little bit Saturday night, and then he'd be back on the road on Monday. But I had a pretty good deal because I was the first child, and in those days, women didn't work. I don't think my wife maybe or my mother could have gotten a job possibly. So I had her undivided attention for 3 years. She taught me how to read, I think, by the time I was three, and she spent a lot of time. And then my brother came along. And things weren't quite so good. My first reaction was to ask my parents if they could take him back. And they didn't think that was a very good idea. I did. So anyway, had fairly normal childhood until December 7th, 1941. December 7th, 1941, I was sitting in the living room of my grandparents. And Sunday afternoon, and word came over the radio that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And my dad jumped out of his chair and said he was going to get into this thing. And I knew something big was up. I was four, didn't totally comprehend it. But he was 37 or 8, which was beyond draft age, had two kids and a family. Didn't have to go, but he did. Kind of a patriotic guy, romantic guy. And so he was gone, and I didn't see him for the better part of the next 5 years. I knew who he was. Occasionally a letter came, and but when you're only that age, 5 years, pretty soon you really don't know that person anymore. My mother, my brother, and I moved in with our grandparents up in St. Paul, Nebraska, north of Grand Island. My mom took a job in an ammunition plant. She'd come home every night and she'd have TNT on her boots. And that was always impressive to me that you could light it with a match and it'd flare up. But then one day I stood in St. Paul and saw the clouds going up over Grand Island, and that plant had blown up. And fortunately, she wasn't in that part of it, but a lot of people were killed. And at that point, my dad wrote and said that she probably ought to quit because one of them probably ought to survive the war. And so she came back to teach school. But anyway, it was a troubled time. And I don't think anyone today realizes it because today you hear about wars, but they're over there, out there, a long ways away, Iraq, Afghanistan, places like that. This was a deal that was for all the marbles. You had the Germans march through Poland, Belgium, France, attack England, on into Russia, and they were taking over Europe. Japanese were taking over the East, China, and you had the Italians linked up in what was called the Axis, and the objective was to conquer the world. And so it was for the whole deal. And you knew that if they won, that they would be here and they would take over. And I remember having nightmares at night that the Nazis were marching down the street. And so difficult time. I remember my mom coming home and sitting down and crying because she didn't get a letter. My dad was cut off in the Battle of the Bulge and we didn't hear from him for 6 weeks. She assumed he was dead. So anyway, that's the backdrop. And then late 1945, my dad came home, and as I said, I really had forgotten who he was, didn't know him, and I wanted to please him, and my dad was very, very interested in athletics. And actually, we moved back to Hastings, Nebraska, and bought a house right across the street from Hastings College. So I was over there every night, watched practice, and whatever it was. And my dad went to all the games, and I wanted to please him. And so I decided maybe the best way to please him was to be an athlete. And so whatever came up, I played it. In the fall, it was football. In the winter, it was basketball. Spring, it was track. Summer, it was baseball. And unfortunately, it wasn't necessarily a case of wanting to be good. It was more a case of, to some degree, having to be good. Probably a little bit of a neurotic tinge to it. And it drove me crazy to sit on the bench. Some of you can relate to that, but that's kind of where I was. And so things went on, and I had a chance to have a little bit of success, and actually was offered football and basketball scholarships here at the university. And they weren't having a lot of success at that time, and I wanted to play both sports. But the football coach said, well, you can't play basketball. If you come here, you got to play football. And the basketball coach said I had to play basketball. So I ended up going to Hastings College, small school, played them all. And but then probably the maybe the most important thing during my early years happened in the summer of 1957. I heard about a summer camp that was going on out in Colorado, and drove out there between my sophomore and junior years in college. And kind of went out there more out of curiosity than anything. And but that week was very, very important to me because I had always been a nominal Christian. I went to church, went to Sunday school, probably didn't live a real wild life in most cases. Probably most of my faith was a somewhat handed down faith of my family. My grandfather was a Presbyterian minister. Didn't know him very well. He was killed by lightning when I was nine. I always kind of looked up to him. I always kind of wondered how I was doing in his eyes. Even though he never wasn't around, I knew somewhere he probably was keeping track of me. And so he was an influence in that way. And so sometime during that week, and I can't pinpoint the exact moment or time, I decided that this is what I was going to do. That I was going to follow Jesus. And what had happened was that I saw a vitality and a virility in Christianity that I had not seen before. I had sat around and observed people in the church. I wasn't sure I really wanted to be like them. You know, I kind of enjoyed knocking people down, and I wasn't real sure about this deal of turning the other cheek. It didn't appeal to me very much. And some of those folks seem like they weren't very very alive. There wasn't much to their lives, and so I was kind of on the fence a little bit. But at this camp, I saw some people that I could relate to, that I understood. And above all, I sensed that Christianity was for everything that you had. I mean, it wasn't something that was going to take part of your life. It would take everything that you had to do it and to do it right. And this appealed to me, that challenge. And it was along about that time that I read a verse of scripture that went something like this. It said, I think it was in the book of Matthew, if any man would save his life, he will lose it. And I began to realize that what had happened with me was that I was trying to save my life by being a good athlete. And I guess my reasoning, almost subconsciously, was this. If I could be a good enough athlete, then other people would approve of me. And if they would approve of me and my dad would approve of me, then I could approve of myself. Because I didn't have very good self-image, you know. I think those years where my dad was gone, everybody else in town had a dad because they were my age and their dads were beyond draft age too, and their dads didn't go. And so I felt a little bit as though I wasn't very worthy. And so I was going to get that sense of worth through athletics. And so what Jesus was saying in that verse of scripture was that whatever you put first in your life, whatever's most important in terms of your time, your talent, your resources, is probably your bet as to how you're going to save your life. And so we can say one thing. You often hear, well, my priorities are number one, God, and number two, it's my family, and number three, it's football, basketball, track, baseball, whatever, you know. And that's the speech. But the question is, what really occupies most of your energy, your thought process, your time, your talent? And if you think about it, that's probably what's first in your life. And so Jesus said, you know, these things all have their place. Nothing wrong with athletics. There's nothing wrong with all these things. But unless you put me first, you're going to lose your life. Eventually, it's all going to come to nothing. And so we live in a very difficult time because you guys are bombarded with advertisement and you're bombarded with all kinds of messages that lead you to believe other things. If you drink this kind of vodka, if you lead a promiscuous lifestyle, if you watch pornography, if you amass a great deal of wealth, if you have this kind of job, then you will be happy. And then you will be fulfilled. But it doesn't seem that that was what Jesus was saying. You know, he's saying, you put me first, then things began to fall into place. And so he said, the other half of the verse of scripture was this, that if any man would lose his life for my sake, he will find it. And that really impacted me because what it meant to me, and maybe it means something else to you, but what it meant to me was that he's asking everything that we have, even unto death, if that's what is required. Hopefully it isn't required of you, but if it were to be required, that's what he's asking. And so it's a costly faith. It's not a cheap faith. And somehow when I began to see that, when I realized that, that there was some substance to this, there was a demand to it, there was something that went beyond what I had heard in Sunday school, began to have meaning and purpose in my life. And so there were some guys there that I could relate to. There, unusually, most of the Oklahoma football team was there. And I still stay in touch with those guys today, some of them. A lot of players from LSU. Doc Walker was there. I don't know if you ever heard of Doc Walker. He was a great player. Otto Graham, one of the best quarterbacks that ever played, Olympic pole vaulter named Bob Richards, and so on. So these were people I could relate to, and it meant a great deal to me. So for that reason, I've always had a great, great loyalty to FCA because it was during that second annual conference that my life was changed in a way that has remained changed for a long, long time. And so if you decide to honor him and serve him and put him first, I think there's some things that will accrue to your life. First thing I think is that your life will begin to have purpose and meaning. And I think essentially that's about all we can ask out of life, is that it counted for something. And many of you may have read some of Stephen Covey's stuff. He wrote the book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. And one of those habits that he mentions that's always impacted me was this one. It was, begin with the end in mind. And what he was saying is you ought to begin your life and consciously live your life in such a way that at the end of your life, you can look back on your life and say, you know, this was the only way to do it. And you've all probably heard the cliche that, you know, you climb the ladder to success and then all of a sudden at the end of your life, you find that that ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. And believe me, if you're my age and you look back and you realize that all of those years and all that time and all that energy and whatever talent you were given was expended in ways that served no purpose, that had no meaning, it would be a true tragedy. I mean, it would be one of the worst things that you could experience. And so you guys, most of you here, are somewhere near the beginning. And you got a chance to do it right. And so I think what Covey was saying certainly is very true. And I remember sitting with some people who were on their deathbed. This is kind of morbid. I don't want to bore you with stuff like this, but one of them was Bob Devaney. Bob was the guy who gave me a chance to be a coach. He was the athletic director here, and so I went over to visit him. I knew he was getting toward the end, and he's kind of a feisty guy. He'd pulled out all the tubes, see, and so he was tired of being like he was, and he wasn't going to put up with it anymore, and so he knew, and I knew, that he wasn't going to be around much longer. And so we had that last visit. And it was kind of interesting because at that time, trophies didn't mean much. He'd won a lot of them. Championships didn't mean a whole lot. The money he'd made wasn't something that we discussed. Recognition he'd received didn't mean anything. But relationships meant something, family meant something, and at that time, he was not known to be a very religious guy, but I asked him if I could say a prayer, and he nodded, and I remember a tear rolled down his cheek, and so I assumed that at that point, where God was important to him. And so at the end of your life, there are certain things that will be important. And what Covey suggests is that you ought to write your obituary from the standpoint of a friend, from the standpoint of a family member, and maybe from the standpoint of a business associate or somebody that you know on your team. Write those three obituaries. And after you've done that, then look at at what you've written down. And probably therein will be the things that at the end of your life will be important, the things that you would want to be said about you at the end. And so I think his point, begin with the end in mind, is certainly very relevant. And certainly where you are spiritually at the end, I think will be very important. Have you been consistent in how you've walked your walk? Will be important at the end. And so I think your life will begin to have purpose and meaning. And even though advertising tells you that happiness will be found in a bottle or a pill or in promiscuity or money or position, these are all eventually dead ends. I have lived long enough to figure that one out because I've seen time after time after time, people trying to find fulfillment in those avenues, and they are blind guides, dead ends. So I think you'll begin to find a purpose. And Jesus said that I've come that you might have life, and have it more abundantly. And what he means is that if you have to live your life in a certain way, the most satisfying way, the way that will lead to long-term sustained satisfaction with your life is to follow him. And I really believe that. Secondly, and this may sound like a strange thing to say, secondly, I hope that you find discipline. And this is a crowd that understands that better than most. Think about your sport. Think about if you were to go out to play an important game tomorrow, important match, whatever it may be, and you hadn't practiced all year. You hadn't been in the weight room, and you didn't have a playbook, you didn't have a plan. You're just going to go out and play. How well do you think you would play? Probably not very well, right? And sometimes, though, it seems like spiritually we figure that we can do that. You know, we go out and play a good game without having practiced, without having been in the weight room, without having exercised any discipline. And so discipline, as you know, involves prayer, meditation, scripture on a regular basis, group worship, this is part of it, and being around people who are fellow believers, certainly that's part of it. And so hopefully you understand that, but I think that probably more than any group I might speak to, you folks here will understand the importance of discipline. I'll tell you a story. I went to Haiti about a dozen years ago with a guy named Don McLennan. Don, coincidentally, was the guy who founded the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Don sold everything he had, including his house. He was married, had a child, and sold everything that he had, lived in a tent, and pursued an idea of using the hero worship, the adulation that athletes are given for the cause of Christ. And so he went to Branch Rickey, who was a baseball manager, and spent hours with him and convinced him to get on board, and some other people, and that's how the FCA started. So Don was kind of an unusual guy, very spiritual guy. So he took me over to Haiti, and we went to a couple of Mother Teresa's homes. First one was for adults that were picked up off the street every night, and these people were dying, and it was kind of a moving experience. We went to the next home, and this was run by the Sisters of Mercy, Mother Teresa's people, and this was a little different deal, because these were all children age 3 and under, and they were all terminal. Most of them had AIDS, and they were all going to die. And so I saw this one sister there who was from Canada, and I figured maybe she could speak English. And I got her aside and I said, "How do you do this?" And she said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, yeah, I understand. Somebody told me that you took your vows just recently, and that means you can't go home to Canada for 10 years. And you work 7 days a week, and you lose 100% of your patients." I said, "How do you do that?" He said, "Well," he said, "it's not that hard." She said, "We have 3 hours a day that we spend in personal devotions and prayer, meditation, scripture, and worship." And she said, "That renews us and that sustains us and that enables us to do what we do." And I thought about that, and I realized that discipline is part of the deal. Somehow in our country, we've lost track of that. We don't realize how important that is. And so I try to spend an hour every morning, usually about 6, in prayer and meditation. Spend a little time in the scriptures in the evening. Try to hit at least one Bible study a week. And of course, try to attend church. And those are the things, I think, that have been important to me. And I think as time goes on, if you stay with the discipline and you stay with that ritual, so to speak, it will pay dividends, just like in your sport. If you're in the weight room regularly if you're at practice every day, if you do the drills, if you do the fundamentals, you get better, you know? And so I think discipline should be part of the picture. And Paul said this, he said, those who compete in the games do it to win a crown that will perish. We do it to win a crown that will last forever. And what Paul realized was in the Greek games, they set themselves apart for 9 months. They were apart from their families. They did not go home to their families for 9 months. And they trained every day, all day, for 9 months. Now that, I would imagine, some of them kind of broke down a little bit. Just think about working out 6, 7, 8 hours a day, but that's what they did. He said if they would do that for a crown of olive branches that turn brown and look pretty bad within 3 or 4 days, what should we do to win a crown that will last forever? And I can relate to that because I saw the price that players would pay in the weight room and in spring football and summer conditioning and fall camp and on to get a ring, you know? And that was all it was a ring. And they would do that year after year after year. And so you think about the price that you guys pay. And so there's another style of discipline that's important too. Third thing I'll mention is probably important to you as well. And that is that you'll begin to maybe look at adversity in a different way if you follow him. And adversity is part of the deal, part of the human condition. We try to escape it as hard as we can, but we can't really get away from it. There will be injuries. There will be times when you get demoted from the second team to the third or the first to the second. There'll be times when you don't play as much as you thought you would. There will be times when you will lose a family member. There will be times when somebody that you don't think you can live without decides they don't really need you around anymore. And those things happen. And so when that happens, people tend to react in different ways. One way is to quit. You know, I've been out here for the team now for 3 years and never started. So I'm going to quit. I've asked her out now 3-4 times, and she's turned me down, so I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit asking her out, and furthermore, I'm going to quit women, period. I'm never going to ask another girl out, ever. The coach has it in for me, and so on. And then a second thing you can do is blame, and I've already kind of mentioned that. The coach doesn't treat you fairly. It's not my fault. It's the coach's fault. It's my teammates' fault. It's the way my parents brought me up. All kinds of things you can do to point the finger when things go badly. Third thing you can do when things don't go well is to say this is an opportunity, you know. This can be a good thing. And it depends on how I relate to it. And if you think about it, of the three ways to handle adversity, the third one is the only way that has any possibility of a positive result. And I'll tell you a story about a guy. He's got a movie out about him now. He lived about 150 years ago. This guy was engaged to be married when he was a young man. And his fiancée suddenly died, and he went into depression. And he was so depressed he couldn't get out of bed. And at that time there was no medication, so he was in bed most of the time for 2 years. Finally recovered enough, he decided he'd start a business. That failed. And then he decided to apply to law school, got rejected. Started another business, that failed. He went into politics. A lot of times when people don't do well in anything else, they become politicians. So he went into politics, and he lost his first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth elections. And of course that was Abraham Lincoln. So the thing he didn't do, he didn't quit, and he didn't blame anybody else. And from every one of those failure experiences, he learned something. He got better. He saw it as an opportunity, you know. And I think that's what our faith calls us to do. Paul said, I've learned how to be abased you know, to really take it in the chin. And I've learned how to abound so that I can handle either one. I can be of service in either case. And so you think about it, you know, he was in prison in Rome for quite a while. And so what happened? Well, he was chained to a guard, chained to the Praetorian Guard. And these guys also served in the palace. And so he converted them. And as a result, within about 100 years or so, the Roman Empire was converted to Christianity. And it started with Paul in a very adverse, very difficult situation, locked in a dungeon down off, not very far from the Roman Colosseum. And I've been there and I've seen it. And so we also think about the letters that he wrote, mostly while he was in prison, and the far-reaching impact of those letters. And so he said, you know, no matter how bad it is, I can be of service. And sometimes, strangely enough, the greatest service you can perform is when you've really encountered a great deal of adversity. And I'll tell you a story about a former player of mine. Sometimes people say, well, what player did you have that was the one who maybe had the greatest impact? And the guy that probably had the greatest impact was a guy who was 1994 was our number two quarterback. And first team quarterback was Tommy Frazier. Tommy was a pretty good player, very good player. And had some blood clots and went down. And they said he might not play again ever. Wouldn't play for the rest of the year. And this other guy stepped in from a small town in western Kansas. And didn't know how he'd play. But he responded pretty well. Played well, won the first game. Next game he got hit in the back and had a collapsed lung. And they went over, took him over to student health and they inflated it like a basketball. And next week he went out there and got hit again and it deflated. And they said, well, if it happens again, he can't play anymore this year either. And so eventually he pulled through and we went on and won 9 straight games and went to the national championship game. And in that game, he played it, and then Frazier came back and was able to play a little bit at the end. We won the whole deal. But the key to it was really the next year because he'd taken us to a national championship and probably in many ways deserved to start. And yet Frazier, you know, had been a good player, and it wasn't his fault that he got hurt. And he was a starter, and so the question was who would be the starter. And so we graded every snap during fall camp, and we just said whoever grades the best is going to start. And we had a great supporting cast in 95. We had a lot of really good players. And I don't think it would have made any difference which one of them started. We'd have still won it all. And it turned out that this particular guy had one turnover in fall camp the whole time. And Frazier had none. So we handed the ball to Frazier. And Frazier started every game. And this other guy just kind of stood on the sideline most of the time, although he played some. And the question was, how was he going to handle that? Because he certainly had a claim. He certainly could have led a group of people on that team that would have backed him. He could have split that team wide open. But he didn't do it. And he said the right thing. He did the right thing. And he handled himself in a way that even though he wasn't a headliner, he wasn't up there on a pedestal anymore, that it really impacted people. And then about 3 months after the season was over, he went up in a small plane out here, and windy day, the engine quit, and he tried to get back to the landing strip so he wouldn't hurt the plane, and went down like a kite, and he died. And but I would have to say that this guy had more impact on our team and our players than anybody that I ever coached because of the way he lived his life, and particularly because of the way that he handled that adversity. because of the way he conducted himself. He was a person of faith. He wasn't afraid to let people know where he stood, and he led by example. And so adversity can be a great teacher. Adversity is probably, in many ways, the best thing that can happen to you, because it shapes you and molds you and makes you into what you're capable of being. And if you're able to handle it, it will make you better. And so it's often said that all things work together for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. And you hear that and you kind of say, well, yeah, that's probably right. But when it happens to you, can you really believe that? You know, can you really believe it? If all of a sudden you have cancer or somebody near you dies, can you say that's really a good thing? Well, it may not be a good thing, but if you relate to it in the right way, it can be a very positive thing in your life. It can make you something that you haven't been before. And so how you relate to adversity has a lot to honoring him and serving him. And when adversity hits, people are looking at you more than when things are going smoothly. That's when you really have those teachable moments. And then lastly, I'll just mention this. I think the thing that you'll encounter, hopefully you will encounter if you follow him and serve him and honor him with what you've been given, is this matter of grace. And we hear that term, grace. But it seems to me that when I've seen people really change their lives significantly, and I've dealt with a lot of players that maybe about the time they left here, they were headed right off a cliff. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen. Didn't look very good. And I might see them 5 years later, 10 years, maybe 15 years later. Had one sitting in my office this morning, a different person. You wouldn't know it was the same guy. And it's always been because of this matter called grace. And so you've all heard the story of the prodigal son. You know it pretty well. This guy was kind of in a hurry. So he's asked his dad for the inheritance, which in the Middle East was the ultimate insult, because that's sort of like telling your dad that you hope he was dead. And so you ask for your inheritance before he's really dead. And he went off and said, I'm going to really have a good time now. I'm going to get away from the old man. Went into a far country and had a riotous time, wild time, and spent all the money. Ended up slopping hogs. And when it got to the point where stuff he was feeding the hogs began to look pretty good to him, he said, what am I doing? He said, my father's servants live a lot better than this. And so he heads back home, all beat up, and he's rehearsing his speech. Father, I've sinned against you and against God, and what am I going to do, and so on. And then the scripture says, while he was still a long ways off, still out there quite a ways, the old man sees him. He's looking for him. And he runs and he throws his arms around him, puts a ring on his finger, and says, let's have a feast, you know, for this son of mine who was lost is found. And so what Jesus was trying to say is that that's what God is like. You know, he's like that old man who's looking for this son who did everything wrong and really didn't deserve anything of merit. And he goes and gives him a ring and wants to throw a feast for him. And see, for centuries, people had believed that God was out there, up there, kind of waiting to zap you, trying to look for everything you did wrong and to punish you. And all of a sudden, Jesus comes and says, that's not what God's like. That's not the deal. And so the message is that you're accepted. Just as you are, no matter what you've done, no matter how far you've strayed, you're accepted. You're created in his image, a little lower than the angels, and you are accepted. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, should not perish, but have everlasting life. And so when you begin to experience the fact that you really are loved, you really are accepted, and you don't have to do anything to really earn it, it makes all the difference in your life. And again, that's something I think will accrue to you if you faithfully follow him over time. And so we hear about this matter of grace and God's influence. And I guess in my case, as I look back, sometimes you don't see it when it happens. But from the perspective of time, you can begin to see the hand of God. When I first got out of college and had a scholarship to seminary, I was thinking about going to seminary. And I also had a chance to play pro football, and I was trying to do both. I was trying to drive 60 miles up north to a seminary and then come back for practice. And I realized I couldn't do it. I had to go across the Bay Bridge, and the traffic was too bad, and had to make a decision. And he said, well, you know, God probably wanted you to go to the seminary, but I felt strongly that somehow football was going to be part of the deal. So I went that way. Was engaged to be married. Didn't know what to do about that one. But somehow it didn't seem like this was going to work out right. And I had to go a different direction. And that has made all the difference. That decision is really a big one for all of you. Went to graduate school and was trained to go into academics, possibly go into college administration. But again, the tug of football was strong. Didn't plan to do it, but again, that decision came. And so I think as I look back, I can see a lot of forks in the road that at the time I didn't know for sure, you know, which way was the right way. But I think that he had a hand in those decisions, and it certainly made a difference. So, well, anyway, that's probably enough for me. I was going to talk to you a little bit about leadership too, but I've gone on long enough here. So it's been a real honor to have a chance to visit with you, and hopefully a few things that I've said might have had some relevance to your lives. And I want to thank you for being here. Just the fact that you are here tonight says something, because evidently there's some tug in your life. There's something in your life that indicates that maybe a spiritual walk is critical, is important. And I guess from my perspective, it is the most important thing, because when you go out to play, you certainly go out to play with your mind and with your body, but you better have your heart and your soul engaged, and you better have everything working and everything in sync. And that's one thing that Jesus will allow you to do, to play in the proper perspective, in the proper spirit, and will certainly enable you to be all that you could be. And that's all we can ask, is that you be all that you can be. So, I don't know, do you want me to open up for questions, or you just want me to leave? You take questions? Okay, we'll take a couple questions if you have them. If you don't, well, I'll be on my way. Anybody have a question? Okay, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think a lot of you will be, if you're in college, you'll be hit with ideas, postmodernism, secular ideas. Professors will put your faith down, those kind of things. Don't worry about that, you know. That doesn't mean anything. Some of the finest people of science, some of the most educated people I know, are people of faith. And So, I was in educational psychology. And at that time in psychology, there were a lot of people trying to figure out why would a rat turn right or left in a maze? Or why would a rat hit a bar to get a pellet of food 3 times instead of 4 times? And they figured if they could figure out what made rats do things, then they could begin to work up the human chain until we could figure out why people behaved as they did. I figured it was going to take an awful long time, you know, because we couldn't even figure out what rats. And the other thing you did, you studied abnormal psychology, you know, why you studied people with schizophrenia, bipolar, all those kind of things. And then there was a guy named Don Clifton over there, and it was kind of different because he said, why do we study the worst and the most deviant? Why don't we study the best? And said, if you want to be a great athlete, why don't we go study 10 of the greatest athletes in the world and find out what sets them apart? Or if we want to find a great insurance salesman, why don't we take the best insurance salesman and see what they're doing different from everybody else? And that made a difference. And Don also said, he studied the Korean War prisoners, and 38% of those prisoners died. And they weren't beaten, they weren't tortured, they weren't malnourished. He said 38% of them died. And the question was why. Well, what happened was that they got them to inform on each other. They informed on themselves. If they'd done something they were really ashamed of, they would have to tell about it, and they'd be rewarded. If there was a negative letter from home, your mortgage was foreclosed, you got it. If there was a positive letter, you never got that. And he began to see that how powerful negativism could be, because people simply gave up and they died. And so he postulated that the reverse would be true, that if there were a lot of positive messages, positive reinforcement, it would bring out the best. And so he said in the workplace, positive reinforcement should outnumber negative by 3 to 1, in a close personal relationship, it's about 6 to 1. So I've often said, if I go home tonight and Nancy's messed up the dinner, and I point that out to her, then I better quickly find 6 positive things to tell her. But as far as that, how that dealt with coaching, we felt the most important thing was not to keep pointing out what people were doing wrong, but to catch them doing something right and to point out that that was what we were looking for. You could change behavior more quickly by catching people doing things right and reinforcing it than to pummel them and downgrade them. And above all, you don't humiliate. You know, you don't denigrate. You don't ever attack a person's character or personhood. And that changed a lot of things. And then there's a guy named John Wooden, who was a very successful basketball coach, probably the winningest guy ever. And yet he never mentioned winning to his team. And I got to know John a little bit. And I puzzled about that. Why would you win all these games and never mention winning? And he said, well, it's all about the process. You know, he said, we talk about how to put your socks on first day, how to bend your knees when you shoot a free throw, what you do, defensive stance, how to pass the ball, the fundamentals. And he said, the winning takes care of itself. If you do the discipline, if the discipline is right, if the drill work is right, then winning and losing will take care of itself. And that's what we did. You know, we never talk about winning. We just talk about doing what we needed to do Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday, and then Thursday. And then Saturday took care of itself. So that's a long answer. So that's probably enough. Okay, well, thank you for your attention, and I want to wish you all the very best. Thank you.